You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hi, everyone, and welcome this evening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming at the Library Foundation. For those not familiar with the Library Foundation, it provides vital support to programs that are essential in keeping Los Angeles Public Library active and engaged in our community. Over the past year, I've curated a series which focuses on power and its effect on our lives. My hope was to look at the underexamined and the overexposed, meaning that often we see images and hear snippets of opinions, but it's rare that we hear from people doing the work on the ground who actually see what is happening from various points of view. This year, we've heard from Robert Reich and Reverend William Barber on the power of inequity, and from Yumisha Alcindor and Brooke Gladstone and Sewell Chen about the power of journalism in our present moment. We've heard from many wonderful people about this subject. Power is a big idea and comes in many forms. It dictates our world, sometimes in obvious ways, like government, and sometimes silently in the politics of the workplace. Tonight, as a part of this series, we're going to look at a topic that couldn't be more timely: policing in America. We'll look at it from many angles, ideas about authority and ideas about law. I'm thrilled to introduce two people who couldn't be more versed on the subject. Rosa Brooks is a law professor at Georgetown University and founder of Georgetown's Innovative Policing Program. From 2016 to 2020, she served as a reserve police officer with the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. She has worked previously at the Human Rights, at the Defense Department, the State Department, and for several international human rights organizations. Her articles and essays have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, and the Wall Street Journal. And she spent 4 years as a weekly opinion columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and another 4 years as a columnist for the Foreign Policy. Her 2016 book, How Everything Became War, and The Military Became Everything, was a New York Times notable book of 2016 and named one of the 5 books of the year. She'll be joined by Christy Lopez, who is a Washington Post contributing columnist and a professor at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. She teaches courses on policing and criminal procedure and co-directs Georgetown's Innovative Policing Program. From 2010 to 2017, Lopez served as a deputy chief in special litigation section of the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice. She led the division's group conducting pattern or practice investigations of police departments and other law enforcement agencies. She directly led the team that investigated the Ferguson Police Department and was a primary drafter of the Ferguson Report. Thank you for being here, Rosa and Christy. Thank you so much. I'm thrilled that you're both here, and I look forward to hearing your discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jessica. Rosa, it's so nice to be here with you tonight to talk about your amazing book, Tangled Up in Blue, Policing the American City. It just came out last week, and it's already getting rave reviews. And I'm so happy for you because it's a great book, and I know how hard you worked on it. And I'm really glad that you're able to share your experience with so many people now. And I think that one of the things that really interests people about your book is that many people are really intrigued by the idea that a law professor and a wife and a mother of two decided to become a reserve police officer in Washington, D.C., of all places. And I want to ask you, I thought we could start the conversation by just going back to that first moment when you realized that this was even a possibility, something that you might do. Do you remember that moment? I think you write about it in the book.
I do, yeah. I remember it very clearly because I was having one of those Kafka-esque government experiences. I had been working at the Defense Department in the early part of the Obama administration on a public service leave from Georgetown. And I had finished more than 2 years. I was going to return to Georgetown. And they said, you can't leave. You have to have your entrance orientation for new federal executives. And I said, but I'm leaving. And they said, well, yes, but we can't process your exit paperwork because you never did your entry orientation. So I go off to this weird event at the old executive office building with a whole bunch of other grumpy people who were obviously also told they had to go to this. And a woman was speaking, and she was speaking about diversity and inclusion in the workplace. And I was kind of zoning in and out as you do at these big workshops and conferences. And she suddenly said, and she was a woman in her 60s, she had white hair, and she suddenly said, you know, look at me, people have all sorts of stereotypes. I'm a white haired lady in her 60s. I'm the oldest person who ever went through the Washington DC Police Academy and became a reserve police officer. And I was like, what, wait, what? You know, I kind of snapped awake and thought, no way. And you can do that, you know, just, you can, anybody can do that. You could become a police officer. You can volunteer and be a reserve police officer. And I started Googling it as I was sitting there. And honestly, it was, it's such a bizarre program in a sense. I mean, very few cities do have volunteer police reserve corps where you're not just giving, you know, directing traffic at a parade or something, but you actually are a sworn armed police officer. And I think I was just so overwhelmed by the weirdness of this and how fascinating it would be to see inside this sort of closed world that I couldn't quite stop thinking about it.
And you thought about it for a while, right? Before you finally decided to sign up.
I did. Yeah. At the time I learned about it, my kids were still pretty young. You know, they were, I think they were, 7 and 9 or something. And I was a single mother, and there was just, I read about it and I discovered you had to be at the police academy for 6 months or more for 2 nights a week and every Saturday. And I just thought, I can't do that. You know, this is so interesting, but I can't do it. And it was only, you know, some years later when I had a sabbatical coming up at Georgetown. And as usual, I had timed things very poorly. I had just finished a book manuscript when my sabbatical started, and you're supposed to use your sabbatical to work on your book, and I got this all messed up. So I had a year and no real project, and I thought maybe I could do that police thing.
I just love that because, I mean, it's so Rosa, right? A lot of people would hear that story and like, oh, that would be so interesting, and then move on. But no, you take that idea, you hold on to it until the moment comes and you actually become a Washington DC police officer. I also love it because it's such a great story of chance encounters. I mean, what if you would have succeeded in getting out of that orientation right. That day? I mean, right. Everything could be quite different.
Never happened, absolutely.
So we're gonna talk a little bit later about your experience in the academy, which is where you started. But I first wanna ask you about that line that we always hear about policing, which is, you know, the first thing that police will tell you when you get out into the streets is to forget everything you learned in the academy. And I'm wondering if that was your experience. Did you, you know, in Washington, D.C. with the Metropolitan Police Department, was there a big dichotomy between what you learned in the academy and then what they told you when you got out into the streets?
I wouldn't say that there was a huge substantive dichotomy. I do think that part of what that cliche is getting at is fair enough and is true everywhere, right? That it's one thing to read about something, to talk about something in a classroom. It's another, even to do role play exercises, simulations, but it's another thing to be doing it for real. And that's, you know, that's true whether you're a doctor or a lawyer. I'm sure you remember the first time you actually had to act like a grown-up lawyer, and it felt really different than the conversations you'd had in the classroom or trial practice classes or something like that. So to some extent, I think all it captures is that sense that's true for everybody. I think that when people say that, often they also mean something a little bit more cynical, which is that in the police academy, you learn these rules. They teach you to be, you know, you're supposed to be ethical and you're supposed to do it by the book. And then you get out there and you know, the real world's not like that. And you have to, you know, you just have to make compromises that you starry-eyed idealistic recruits might not imagine. And I think that I'm happy to say that I don't think in DC I felt there was a radical, I didn't think that people were cutting corners in ways that were really negative. I thought it was more just the first issue of it was, it's different to be doing something for real. You said you wanted to talk about this in a few minutes. I mostly was just struck by all the things that we hadn't talked about the academy at all. It wasn't that I had to forget something we'd learned. It was more just that once I was out there patrolling, I thought, I can't believe we never talked about this and this and this and this and this, because we really should have.
Yeah, so let's talk about that a little bit. I want to talk where that came from, because that's, of course, the first time I met you. Well, we crossed paths in law school, I think, but when I really got to know you was at Georgetown when I first got there after leaving DOJ. And you approached me about starting this program for MPD officers. And you really talked about how struck you were when you were in the academy about that lack of information that seemed really important. Tell us a little bit more about what the academy experience was like, what you thought was lacking, and what inspired you to want to do this program. And then we can talk in a bit about what that program actually is.
Yeah. So, when I was at the academy, a lot of things really struck me, but one of them was that this was 2016. And then as now, the whole country was having a really impassioned conversation about policing, about race in policing, about the use of force in policing. There were protests in many American cities, not at the level that we saw in 2020, but at a very significant level nonetheless. And every time you turned on the news, there was a story about policing and racism or policing and excessive force. So everybody's talking about this, except at the DC Police Academy, right? It's the police academy in the nation's capital, but the curriculum was overwhelmingly tactical in nature, certainly at that time, and it has changed a good deal since. But we learned to memorize the 9 property forms and what color pen you had to fill them out in, and the proper abbreviation for the days of the week on different forms, which, believe it or not, is different on different forms. And we learned how to apply the right technique for applying handcuffs to a prone person versus a kneeling person versus a standing person. But we didn't talk about race, except in order to be told race doesn't matter to us. We don't discriminate. Everybody bleeds blue. You have to show everybody respect. The end. That was the conversation about race. We didn't talk about police shootings, or we didn't talk about what's policing for. We didn't talk about what is good policing and how do you measure it and how do you know it when you've got it and do we know what it is. We didn't talk about the changing demographics of DC. We didn't talk about what drives rising or falling crime rates. Do we know? We didn't talk about any of those issues. And that was kind of mind blowing to me.
Did you have a sense that after you got on the streets, after you got out of the academy, did you have a sense of where that information would have come in handy, why it would have been helpful for officers to know those things?
You know, part of it is it's just context, right? As a police officer, it's a strange occupation in a sense, because on the one hand, patrol officers are kind of the lowest of the low within police departments. They're supposed to do what they're told. They're not supposed to be asking questions and challenging the way the department is structured or organized or policy decisions. On the other hand, in a sort of minute-to-minute sense, they have a tremendous amount of autonomy. They're out there either alone or with one partner, and they're constantly called upon to make decisions on the fly about, what do we do here? Do we arrest somebody? Do we not arrest somebody? Do we stop somebody? Do we not stop them? Do we search them? Do we not search them? You know, is this a situation where compassion and kindness is called for, or where, you know, firmness and an authoritative approach is called for? And we don't really give them any guidance on how to make those decisions, or what's at stake, or why you should think about alternatives to arrest and under which circumstances, or what happens to people who get arrested. You know, what is the impact on their life, and how you might want to try to juggle in your mind, you know, what is the potential value of arresting this person, but versus the potential costs to them and to the community of making an arrest. We didn't talk about the way in which gentrification and changing demographics in DC were driving particular kinds of complaints to police and 911 calls, and what you should do about that. So yeah, it did seem to me constantly like, boy, there's a lot that it would have been nice to have thought about together before we were out here on the streets with this simultaneous sense of being at the bottom of the totem pole in the police department, but with tremendous authority over human beings to take away their freedom, potentially even take away their lives. And yet we'd never really talked about any of those issues.
Yeah, and I think it's a dichotomy that a lot of people don't, or It's just an ambiguity about policing that a lot of people don't understand. The way that officers aren't really sure where they stand, and they know they have all this power externally, and they're viewed as such, but internally they don't, especially patrol officers, they often don't feel that way.
No, that's the equivalent of like lowly privates in the military. Nobody says to them, how should we do this? They say, get out there and do what I tell you, but then they're left alone to figure out
and to literally be the face of our democracy, right? Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing, profound responsibility. And it's interesting to hear about all the things you wish they would have heard about and learned about, because of course,
this is what happens in Zooms. My dog is now attempting to participate in this event because she feels left out. Scout,
he's just excited. Scout's just excited about your book.
I came prepared. I have these dental floss bones. I'm now
going to nice
with a dental floss bone.
So while you're helping out Scout. Oh, hi Scout.
Come on, hush, Scouty. Sorry, everybody.
So it's interesting to hear you talk about all the things that you wanted people that you thought officers should be learning about, because of course, those are any of the topics that we talked about. We talk about in our Police for Tomorrow Fellowship workshops. And I wanted to ask you about a couple of, you talked about the importance of people understanding, the impact of gentrification and especially the alternatives to arrest. You talked about the officers under the impact of an arrest. And I'm remembering that the workshop that we did on alternatives to arrest, what just got an amazing response from our officers who were almost, it seemed as if they were almost grateful to be given permission, that it was okay to do one of these things other than arrest people. And I know that in MPD, there's a lot of emphasis on using your discretion not to arrest from some segments, but in other segments, officers tell us that they feel pressured to make those arrests, make those stops. Can you talk to us a little bit about how those differences played out for you, if they did, and also just a little bit about where you were policing in the city and how that might have impacted how you were policing and how other officers policed there?
Yeah, well, I guess to take that last question first, I was assigned to the 7th District in Washington, D.C., which for those not familiar with D.C. is the southern part of Anacostia. Oops. Dental floss bone did not work, maybe because she disapproves of the whole concept of a dental toothbrushing bone. It's the poorest part of the city. It's the part of the city that in a typical year has the lion's share of homicides and other violent crimes. And it is mostly African-American community with a very rich history and culture. But also, a lot of serious problems. It doesn't have a lot of grocery stores. It doesn't have a great public transportation network. All the problems that often plague poor city communities.
A legacy of structural racism.
Of discriminatory zoning laws, of tax incentives that favor other neighborhoods and other people, you name it. Which is to say that if you grow up in that neighborhood and you want to get a good education, get a good job, be healthy, you're going to face barriers that you would not be facing if you were in the affluent parts of, say, Northwest DC. So the kinds of calls that would come in, the calls that would come in on the radio that we would go to as officers, lots and lots of disorderly conduct calls, which could be, typically could be anything from my neighbors having a loud party and the music's too loud, make it stop, to people are, they're drug dealers on the street, and I'm scared to walk by them. We got lots and lots of robbery, including a lot of armed robbery calls, lots of sounds of gunshots calls, and lots of assault and domestic violence calls. That being said, and I there is violent crime and homicides in DC have skyrocketed in the last year. A couple of years they've gone way up, which has been the case in many American cities. A real puzzle since violent crime overall has gone down. But so there is serious crime that really hurts people, but that being said, the majority of the arrests that are made in Washington, D.C., as in so many other cities, are for these sort of breathtakingly trivial offenses a lot of the time. They're so trivial that a pretty substantial percentage get what is referred to in DC as no papered by prosecutors. And what that means is that the prosecutors essentially decide that either the case is too weak, legally speaking, to bother going forward, or the case is so trivial that it's not worth wasting further public funds and time on it, and they get tossed out without even going any further. Yet, of course, even if someone's case is, if you've arrested someone and the case is no papered, that person still has an arrest on their record and so on, with all of the consequences that may have.
Yeah, it's so ironic and such a disconnect to me when you have, especially when you have a city and an area in a city that is facing such significant challenges and significant violence, that so much time is being spent arresting on these smaller offenses. It's we've got to get the logic a little better. It seems to me.
Well, and particularly because, as you know, most of those arrests, you know, I was willing to be a police officer. I believe that there are arrests that need to be made and there are people who need to go to prison, but most of those arrests, most of the time, were ones that didn't make anybody better off. You know,
you talk about a few of those arrests in your book, and there's one in particular, yeah, I'm wondering if you can share with us, that really made you think hard about policing and whether you could be part of it and for how much longer. Can you tell us a little bit about
there were several of those. I'm not sure which one you were thinking of, but you know, one, for instance, involved a domestic violence call, and we got there and it turned out it was a fight between a mother and a daughter and had escalated to hair pulling and maybe slapping. And it was a terrible situation. The daughter was in the custody of a grandmother. She wasn't living with her mother. She felt very abandoned by her mother and rejected by her mother. I don't know the sort of deep backstory, but she was crying and saying, my mother wants to see everybody except for me. My mother doesn't care about me. And somehow or other, I was very new. I was pretty new on the job. And while I was talking to the girl, my partner and the sergeant who'd arrived decided that she was the primary aggressor in the altercation. And because Washington, D.C. has a mandatory arrest rule for domestic violence, we had to arrest her. And that mandatory arrest rule is a story of well-intentioned reform with unintended consequences. It was created in the era in which too often when men abused their intimate partners, cops shrugged their shoulders and walked away and said, sort it out. Was trying to force police to take seriously the idea that you had to arrest the male abuser. But over time, DC expanded the category of what they defined as domestic relationship to include adult, you know, mothers and daughters, adult siblings, housemates and roommates, former housemates and roommates. And what that meant was an astonishing amount of really minor altercations that technically constituted assault, but were not what anybody had in mind back when the mandatory arrest rule was made, led to people being arrested. So we arrested this teenage girl. She was 16 or 17 years old. She was crying because she felt rejected by her mother. And I was like, I felt, you know, I just remember feeling kind of sick and just feeling like, you know, my own daughters were only a little bit younger at the time than she was. And just thinking, if my child felt rejected by me and got so mad that she slapped me and then was taken off to prison, even if it was just for a night, you know, what are we doing?
Yeah, there's a lot of interventions that a community and one's, you know, and public services that family might need, but it's not clear that police didn't arrest.
No. Yeah. And one thing that really struck me, and obviously these are things that I was not unaware of before I started this, but just, you know, hit you in a very visceral way when you're actually doing it rather than reading about it or talking about it in a more theoretical sense, was, you know, just, we've criminalized so many trivial offenses. We have so few alternatives. And it's not just that the problem is bad policing. You know, there are bad apples. Of course, there are bad apples. There are cops who are bullies and sadists and so on. Most of them aren't. The problem is that even good policing by diligent, ethical, responsible officers, even good policing can have incredibly harmful results because it's a system that has so many injustices, racial injustice, economic injustice, just general indifference and cruelty, just so deeply baked into it that, that by the time police get to a scene, all of the choices are bad ones.
Yeah, I mean, that's so true. And it's also the case, right, that the police officers, they're told to go out and do a job, right? They get dispatched to a call, there's a fight, break it up, there's, you know, but they have no say over what the penalty is. So for example, when they arrest someone, it might be that it's not such a bad thing to, you know, have a cooling off period for a few hours, maybe even a few days, but they have no idea that that might end up being years for people. It's not in their control, yet they're connected with that by the community, by the public, because they're the ones, you know, they're the gatekeepers, as we say, that system. And so they take the blame for it, even regardless if they were, you know, if they had any say in what the prosecution would be, what the sentence would be. You tell another story in your book, about, I think, at least for me, provides an example where we really do, you know, want policing and where we're really grateful for good police. You talk about you and your partner going into, being dispatched to a call where there was a possible break into a home. Do you remember this one? Do you know what I'm talking about here?
Yeah, I think so. We get a call for a burglary, potential burglary in progress, because an empty house and burglar alarm's going off, and we get there. And the door to the apartment is ajar. And there's a dark, door is ajar. We look in, there's a dark room, and my partner, this is when I was very, very early in my patrol experience. I was just relatively recently out of the academy. And so my partner pulls his weapon and holds it down by his side. And so I do the same thing. And we tiptoe into the living room, this dark living room. And as we're kind of tiptoeing in, because you're thinking the doors are dry, there could be a burglary in progress. There could be some armed burglars in the apartment. And suddenly a light pops on at the other end of the room, in a hallway, the other end of the room, and a figure pops out at us, kind of silhouetted against the light behind it. And, you know, that's the kind of situation that people get killed, right? You know, somebody, cops have their weapons out. It's a scary situation. It's dark. Someone comes out of nowhere rapidly. They're not expecting
it. And we're in America, so you know that person has a gun.
You assume that everybody is armed. And, you know, my partner, bless him, was a very calm guy. He was a former Marine, and he didn't do a thing. You know, he said in a very calm voice, he said, "Hey there, you know, we're from the Metropolitan Police. Would you mind coming out here so we can see you?" In a completely calm voice. And the figure kind of had disappeared again while he's saying this. And we hear this kind of panicky voice coming from somewhere out of sight. He says, "I can't." And it sounds like a teenage boy. It's, you know, you can tell from his voice, it's sort of half breaking. And my partner says, "Why not?" And he says, "I'm naked." And my partner, he says, and he says, "I just got out of the shower, I'm naked." And my partner, you know, again, a different officer might have responded very, very differently, but he says, "Well, you know, how about you put a towel on or something?" And the kid goes, "Okay, okay." And then a minute later, this kid comes out. He's got a towel around his waist and he's dripping wet and his eyes are like saucers. He's completely freaked out. And, you know, we holstered our weapons and just said, "Hey, you know, we got a call for a burglary. We're just checking it out." And the kid goes, "Oh, you know, my dad is out of town. I live with my mom, but I just came by because, you know, I want to take a shower and do my laundry. And I guess I forgot to close the door." And we get the dad on the phone and he says to the kid, "You know, for God's sake, you know, close the door and turn off the alarm." And the kid says, yeah, sorry, dad. And it was fine. You know, it was one of those non-events in a sense. We didn't even have to file a police report because nothing happened. We just said secure, you know, building is secure, is no issue. But it really kept going through my head how easily there could have been a dead kid in that apartment.
Yeah, it's really scary. And it reminds you how much good policing happens every day, that, you know, that we shouldn't, no one gets a gold star for that, but we should acknowledge that it happens and how important that is.
I mean, I think one of the things that was really borne in upon me during this whole experience was that when we are critical of policing, we often don't distinguish between criticisms of the criminal justice system or of broader social and economic inequities versus what is a criticism of police and the things that they have control over. There are certainly things about policing that police can change. You know, police departments can change training, they can change recruiting, they can change how they structure patrol shifts, the kinds of behaviors they reward and so on. The, you know, there's plenty that is important and within the control of police departments. But as you were saying a minute ago, much about policing can't be changed by cops. You know, that police officers enforce laws that they didn't create in a social context that they can't do much to change. And legislators, the people we elect, prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, and, you know, ultimately all of us, because we are the citizens, we created this system in which we've over-criminalized trivial offenses, we have excessively long sentences, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We have asked police officers to do certain kinds of things that arguably they should not be doing at all, but that's what we tell them to do. And when we say, oh, you know, policing is violent and brutal and racist, sometimes that's a way to avoid looking in the mirror and saying, oh, you know, we voted for the people who passed these laws, you know, it's our responsibility too.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I just absolutely love the dedication of your book for the men and women of the DC Metropolitan Police Department who do what we ask them to do. And I do think, I especially feel this acutely as an attorney, as a lawyer, you know, our field is full of prosecutors, of judges, of legislators who make these laws, who, you know, charge these charges, who send people, you know, send people to prison. And you know, and we get, for the most part, paid quite well. You know, we have advanced degrees, you know, but we send these officers out there, blue collar workers, and you know, say, hey, carry out what we've decided the system is going to look like. We need you to carry it out. And it's not just the lawyers, of course. It's every individual who lives in a city who votes one way or doesn't vote another way, or, you know, and I think that's really such an important point that I think comes through your book, that officers are doing what we ask them to do. Not that they're all, there's definitely some problems with some of the officers and some policing. And I wonder if we can go back to your time at the academy, because, I want maybe just to start there, but to carry this through, it's different to be a woman in policing, right? And I'm wondering how that played out for you and what you learned about that and what you think about the role of women in policing in particular. Now that you're on the other side of this, because you're no longer a reserve officer, we should say, if we had, I think it was a few months ago that you, mm-hmm. you stopped doing that, but you learned a lot during that time.
Yeah, it was a fascinating time. It was also a humbling time. I did learn a lot. I mean, you know, I think I went into this thinking, you know, how hard could it be? These, you know, 22-year-olds with community college degrees can do it. I'm smart. I can do it. You know. And it was incredibly humbling because, you know, I was not the best cop. I mean, I think I was pretty good at the talking to people part of it, but, you know, there were a million things of, you know, memorizing this and that and knowing which official to call and knowing the, you know, tactical approach to this and that I never was particularly good at. And partly that's because I was a part-timer. You know, there is a lot of muscle memory and perishable skills. But part of that is just because it's hard. Being a cop is hard. We ask police to do many, we ask them to do so many contradictory things. We're asking them to be warriors and protectors and medics and mentors and mediators and social workers. And any one of those things is really, really hard to do well. And trying to say to somebody, do all of them in the space of a single shift is just impossible for people to do well. I do think, I mean, your question about gender, you know, it's a hard question to answer because I'm always a little bit wary of saying, well, you know, women are just different or whatever, right? You wade into this essentialist versus non-essentialist arguments about gender. But that being said, there is a lot of research that suggests that whatever the reason, nature, nurture, culture, women police in different ways than men on, you know, in the aggregate, and that women are less likely to use excessive force. They are more likely to treat people in what is perceived as a respectful way. They also, as you know, Christy, they cost cities and police departments a lot less money per capita than male cops because they're less likely to use excessive force and behave abusively. Cities end up, you know, per women cops paying out a lot less money in court ordered damages or court settlements when there are complaints about bad police behavior than they do for male cops. At the moment, women nationwide make up only about 12% of all sworn law enforcement officers in the country, which is a stunningly low figure. It's significantly lower even than the percentage of women in the US military, which is more like 16% at this point. It just stalled out a couple decades ago and hasn't really risen.
That's what's amazing is it's been stuck at 12% for so long. Although at MPD, I think it's like 22%, which is incredibly high.
But it's hovered just below 20% for most of the last few years, which is higher than many departments, but still stunningly low.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can't write home about 20%, but the fact that that's actually doing some of other agencies. So what is it about policing? Why, you know, I mean, I think we can imagine some things. Are there things about policing that are inherently are inhospitable to women, or are there things that the police departments can change? No. What do you think?
And you know, Christy, you came up with this great exercise. I should tell our listeners that you and I on and off have co-taught a course together on policing, and you came up with this fantastic exercise that students really love, and it's very revealing, where you ask students to poke around on YouTube and find recruiting videos for police departments and look at the ways in which the role of police officers is depicted. And look for examples of good examples and bad examples. And it is truly amazing the percentage of police departments that think a great way to recruit is to have a lot of videos of, you know, people jumping out of helicopters and smashing in doors and, you know, tackling running suspects and throwing them to the ground and doing push-ups at the academy, right?
Always.
There are other police departments that instead have recruiting videos that depict people, you know, helping little old ladies across the street and, you know, taking sick people to the hospital and talking to kids. And, you know, it's not a huge leap to think that there is some relationship between which of these approaches departments take in their recruiting and whether they're more likely to recruit women. The more, you know, policing is in many ways, and I do think this gets lost too in the, you know, the current political climate. There's a lot that's wrong with policing, but police also do help people. You know, that police respond to 911 calls. People call the police and say, please come, something bad is happening and I need help. And police go, and they do often help. You know, there are times that they don't help. There are times that they make things worse, but there are also a lot of times that the job is helping. The job is, my husband, I think he had a heart attack, he's unconscious, what do I do? You know, my daughter didn't come home, what do I do? I was robbed, what do I do? And I do think that the recruiting tactics that emphasize that you're helping people in distress, tend to get a lot more women applicants than the ones that say, you know, you're gonna be kicking in doors and slamming people to the ground.
Well, and I think that's, I'm sure that's right, at least a lot more of some type of women officers. But I think just as importantly is I think you're going to attract a different kind of male officer.
Yes, as absolutely. Well, right? Absolutely.
I think that's really important, and that we've had this conversation before, but I really like to, I don't want to put it on, you know, on the backs of women to fix policing, right, or the women of you know, Black or Latina officers to fix policing. We need individuals of all sorts, of all backgrounds, of all life experiences, you know, of all national origins. We need people who are not just criminal justice majors, but also culinary arts majors, and, you know, all those sorts of things.
Right, social workers, you know, and teachers, and
yeah, I mean, this is what policing should be made up of, even though, you know, they've got this particular set. But, you know, you mentioned a lot of things just now. People call 911. And they need, you know, they say, I've got someone who's sick, I don't know where my child is. You know, and that, of course, raises in my mind this whole issue of how we've come to over rely on policing. And why is it that when you call 911 and you have a call about, you know, someone is sick, why in the world should a police officer go out there? Obviously, you need some medical care. Or, you know, even if, you know, hey, my daughter and my wife are fighting. And, you know, why don't we get the police out there to, you know, along the lines of what you were talking about earlier? Maybe we send a social worker out there. Tell us a little about, you know, what's your take on defund and this over-reliance on police and shifting resources? What do you think about all that now that you've been there and walked the walk?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, on the one hand, I do think that defund the police was a kind of unfortunate slogan because people hear it and they're like, what? And police officers hear it. And, you know, I could just picture people, you know, in the 7th District Police Station saying, defund, you think we have too much money? Have you looked at our station? Have you looked at our vehicles? Have you looked at our equipment? You know, they're crappy. You're telling me that I have to do everything I do with less, with even fewer resources? That's, you know, I don't like you, go away, right? But if you shift the conversation and ask the question that you just asked instead, you know, if instead you say to officers, what are the things that you do that you don't think need your skills, or you don't think that your skills equip you to do effectively? You know, where are the moments where you really wish there were other options, either other people who would respond, or other types of outcomes when you respond, whether it's, you know, more shelter for people who are on the streets, whether it's better mental health care, then I think you get a lot of police officers saying, yeah, it's crazy that we do this. It's nuts that we do this. If only there was a better mental health system, if only I felt like there was someplace that I knew I could send this person who's homeless where he wouldn't be back out on the street again tomorrow. You know, and that's where I think you actually find a tremendous amount of common ground potentially between police officers and critics of policing. You know, I think if you get past the language, which can be off-putting to people, and focus on where should we be making investments so that we can meet the needs of communities more effectively, you get a much better conversation.
Yeah, and I think you and I have experienced that dynamic ourselves in meeting with our, you know, in our Police for Tomorrow Fellowship. The officers are all pretty new officers. And we have sessions on interactions with people in mental health crisis, and they tell us, you know, we don't like the options when we respond to a mental health crisis call. And why are we responding anyway? Why don't we have, you know, mental health workers respond? They say that to us, that they don't want to be the ones who go out there. They know they're not, even if they're well-trained, right? They're not mental health workers. And unless there's a weapon involved, they don't feel like they need to be there. So I think when you and I are hearing that directly from officers, and this has been for me the overwhelming story or theme of the Police for Tomorrow program, you really realize how much overlap there is and how much commonality and sort of we can all agree on some of the solutions to this if people can just get talking to each other. It's one of the, I think, the most unfortunate things about some of the recent dynamics. There's been so much good to come out of recent movements, but one of the downsides is this, there's been less talking with the people who really do most of this work, you know, the patrol officers, the line officers. So I think it's really important. So I think we are going to go to questions in just a moment or two. So if people do have questions, please get those to us in the chat. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about our innovative policing program that we started. And I guess I was thinking about what to talk to you about this part of it, because it did come out of this experience that you had. And so I'm happy to hear sort of what you think about that and why you decided to go that direction. But what I'd really love to hear is kind of, what's your favorite part of it? What do you like about it? What do you think is working about it? What do you want people to know about it?
Yeah, you know, so I, coming out of the police academy and starting work as a part-time volunteer patrol officer, you know, these contradictions were very much on my mind. And if you hear, by the way, crunching in the background, that's because I gave my dog another little treat to keep her busy while we're talking. Sorry. You know, it was very much on my mind, these gaps, the things that we didn't talk about at the police academy, and the ways in which I think officers are left very ill-equipped to have the context to make smart decisions sometimes. And I do remember thinking, well, my problem is I'm actually not an expert on police reform or anything. You know, my background is elsewhere. It's in international law, national security law, human rights law. And I immediately glommed onto you, Christy, because I thought, here we have Christy Lopez. She's worked on investigating some of the worst police departments in the country for years. And if I could get Christy and some of our other wonderful colleagues at Georgetown, we have former prosecutors, former public defenders, prison reform experts. Wouldn't it be great if we could put together a program where we create a space for young officers in DC to come and have those hard conversations about race and policing, about force and policing, about the role of police, about how you figure out whether policing is working, whatever you think working means. That would be a really great thing to do. And so the program we put together is one, as you know, Christy, where we young officers apply. It's a selective program to be fellows. And those who are selected come to Georgetown Law for these very intensive workshops where they are meeting with local kids, they're meeting with homelessness rights advocates, they're meeting with community activists, they're meeting with scholars. We're pushing them to think about and talk about all these hard issues. And ultimately they do a sort of a capstone community project and they graduate eventually. We're now in our third cohort of fellows, 3.5 years into the program. I think the things that have been most exciting about it are really two things. One is to see how hungry a lot of these young officers are to be part of those conversations. You know, that they want to have those conversations. They don't want to be stuck in a, well, I just do push-ups and say, yes, sir. And, you know, I guess that's what I do. They want to be talking about what their profession is for and how do they make it better. And they really support each other. I'd like to think that it's helping to sort of foster a new generation of police leaders who will think about policing very differently than the generation that came, you know, before them 2 decades or 3 decades ago, who are now at the senior levels. So that's one thing, is just kind of feeling like it helps foster a new generation of change agents within policing. And the other thing is I feel like it has already made a concrete difference in DC, in that we bring sometimes the senior officials from the police department into the same room as our young fellows, and they get an earful. They get an earful from the rising generation of officers about, hey, here's how this looks to us, and here's what doesn't seem right to us. And, you know, one thing I give a tremendous amount of credit to the DC Metropolitan Police Department is they've been willing to listen. And sometimes to really try to make changes based on going, oh, we didn't know that. We thought this worked. I guess you're telling us it doesn't work. And so feeling like that has really been part of bringing about change that really helps the community.
Yeah, I've really been struck by that as well. I hadn't really thought in such, I think this is such an important lesson for so many of us, no matter what we're doing. But I hadn't really thought about the fact that it had been so many years since so many of these higher level people at MPD who are making these decisions, since they had been on the streets really on a regular basis dealing with patrol issues. And there's not an opportunity for them to have really honest conversations in sort of a safe space with the people who are doing the work. And they get an earful when they come in there, not in a negative way, but in a really constructive way that I think, you know, does have an influence on the positions they take on things and the direction they want to move.
And the only other thing I'd say, and I know we've got some questions lined up now, that was our keystone project. We now have a lot of other things we do, including a focus on active bystandership, skills for law enforcement that you spearheaded, and many other things. And all of these are things that can be done in other places and that are being done in other places. We have a sister program in New Orleans now that's modeled on ours. The active bystandership program has dozens and dozens of departments around the country now participating. And all of this stuff is replicable all over the country. You know, there's nothing magical about DC.
And all of this happened because you actually went to that orientation class that day.
Well, no, that's probably an exaggeration, but...
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. So it's a real testament to that chance moment. And I think about that also when we're talking with our officers, hoping that these conversations, you never know which part of these conversations are going to take hold as they're deciding who they are as officers. Yeah. So I definitely appreciate that. So I want to turn to our questions now. We have a lot of them. Well, the first one I want to ask is, there's a question about what feedback you've received from current officers about this book.
Well, the book only came out a week ago, so it's early days. I would say so far the feedback has been extremely positive, which I was a little nervous, to be honest. I mean, I think this book was what, you know, as you know, Christy, because you heard me kind of agonizing over it many times in the last couple of years. I thought there is a danger that this book will be attacked by cops for being anti-cop and attacked by police critics for being pro-cop, and absolutely, absolutely everybody will hate it. And so far, you know, my fingers are crossed. You know, I've been pleasantly surprised. I've gotten a lot of emails from police officers, some who I know, some who I don't know, saying, you know, thank you, that I think you highlighted the tensions that I experience in my day-to-day life really effectively. And that's really gratifying, because I wanted to write a book that was honest and that showed that challenge. I mean, I think, you know, we live in a political culture where everybody loves these kind of binary oppositions. And depending who you talk to, it's either, you know, police are underappreciated heroes and I won't hear a word against them, or police, they're brutal racist thugs and I won't hear a word in favor. And you know, the reality is a whole lot more complicated than that. And I tried to portray that, and I hope that is coming through.
Yeah, I certainly thought it came through. I think, you know, as I've said, I think it's hard to find a more objective book. You really just try to put the facts out there. And it's hard to find that, I think, these days. People really want you. They want to convince you before they're done talking. But I think one of the nice things about this book is you just put it out there and people can decide. Another question we have is about the homicide rate, and particularly in DC. And I don't know that you know the answer to this, but I bet you have some thoughts about so many homicides go unsolved. The clearance rates, which, you know, as they often call them, they're defined differently in different places, so it's sometimes hard to tell. To compare different cities, but they're awful low in a lot of places. I remember when we conducted the Chicago investigation, they were down in the 20s in the previous years. They're often around 60%, 40%. A lot of homicides don't go solved, and that's true in DC as well. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I don't think we entirely know. And Christy, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because you have more experience in trying to figure that out than I do. But you know, I suspect that one significant reason is that we increasingly have in many cities police officers who don't have any significant, meaningful connections to the communities in which they're working. And you know, this, I was having an earlier conversation with someone today about like stop and frisk, right? Where, you know, you can aggressively stop people and frisk them in an effort to get guns off the street, and you'll get a certain number of guns off the street. But, you know, for every gun you get off the street, you'll have, you know, 9 people or 90 people who are angry and humiliated and frightened because you stopped them, they didn't have a gun, and now they're really upset and they don't trust you and they don't like you. And they're a whole lot less likely to come to you and say, listen, here's what I heard, something bad is going down, here are the people who are involved. You know, that if the only contacts you have with people in a community are enforcement contacts where you're saying, you know, hey, over here, you know, I need to frisk you, you're not going to get a whole lot of people eagerly coming to you hoping to share important information about crime that will help you solve crimes. You know, the enforcement, an overly heavy-handed enforcement approach can actually backfire significantly and reduce your ability to get the vital information to close cases.
Yeah, there certainly does seem to be some evidence of that. And it's both the sort of not feeling like, you know, like you want to go to this person who is harassing you, but also kind of on the flip side of that, of not really feeling confident that this person is going to protect you if you take that risk of coming forward, because they haven't really exhibited that they're interested in protecting you. And I think that's a dynamic and a and a culture that needs to change. So we have time for one or two more questions. Here's a great question. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Police unions, you come from a long family of pro-union people. Police unions are a little bit different. What do we think about police unions?
We don't think super positively about police unions. They have not overall been a force for progressive change. Let me just say that. That being said, it's not that I think that, cops are people too. And that's one of the points of the book. And they, just like the rest of us, deserve decent working conditions and some control over their working conditions and so on. You know, there should absolutely be unions. I think the trouble is that we have some police unions that have just been incredibly regressive. And we were actually, Christy, we were talking about this with some of the young officers we know. And it was interesting listening to them talk to each other and challenge each other and say, we should get active in our union, because we don't feel that our union is representing us very well. We feel it's representing a kind of old guard view of policing. So I don't give up on the possibility of police unions playing a more positive role in the future, but they sure haven't done it very much so far.
Yeah, I do fear that that's the case. Well, I'd like to end on a more positive note. I want to give you the last word, Rosa. You know, what's your overall takeaway from this? What is something that you'll take away from your experience policing, a positive thing that you can take? I know this is kind of a big question, mm-hmm. but I think I feel like this is a theme woven throughout the book of something that you've learned. You've talked about how it was humbling. What's your lesson from policing that you want people to know? Since not all of us are going to be brave enough to academy or fit enough to go through the academy, tell us what we should all know.
Not sure I would be anymore. I think one thing I hope people will take away from this is something we were talking about earlier. If you want to fix policing, you can't just, say cops are bad. Down with cops, abolish it. You need to recognize that a lot of what's wrong with policing is the responsibility of the rest of us to fix, and police can't change the laws. We need to do that. We need to demand that our elected officials do that. At the same time, that doesn't let the cops off the hook. Police departments, we should be putting pressure on them to change what they can change, but we shouldn't be letting ourselves off the hook either. And that wasn't really a positive thing, was it? That was a lesson, but not a positive thing.
It should be inspiring.
The positive thing, though, and you've seen it too, Christy, there, and this is going to sound corny, but we're teachers, among other things, and watching the conversations that take place between the young officers in our Police for Tomorrow program, some of our law students, community activists, former prisoners. So those are some pretty amazing conversations where people are really challenging each other, and watching them come out of it with everybody saying, I didn't think of it that way before. I now have a different set of ideas about what I can and should do to make my community better, to make the department better. And that's pretty amazing.
I agree with you. And I think that continued conversation is an important part, not because it makes us feel better, but because it's going to make us do better as a country and as policing. Yeah. So thank you so much, Rosa. Thank you for your work. Thank you for your dedication to this topic. And thank you for being with me here tonight.
Well, Christy, thank you so much for being my partner in all of these efforts.
Thank you both. Thank you, Rosa and Christy. This is amazing. And thank you for all that you do. This is a great discussion, and you both do such amazing work.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us, Jessica. It's been great to talk to the audience here.
And to our members, I want to thank you from all of us, and I'm very grateful for you making this program possible. And for those who are not members, please consider joining lfla.org/support. On March 1st, under again the Power series, you'll want to tune in for a compelling and important conversation about the ongoing challenges of disability discrimination in law, politics, and society. And thank you both again, and have a wonderful rest of your evening, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening.
Bye-bye.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.